Radio, KMUD Garberville, 91.1 on your FM dial, KMUE Eureka, 88.1 FM, KLAI Laytonville, 90.3 FM, and Shelter Cove at 99.5, and we are everywhere worldwide at KMUD.org. This is a rebroadcast of last night's local news. To this morning on This Way Out, a queer history of Australian TV, part two. Stay tuned for that.
Today is Wednesday, May 24th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, CHP to implement maximum enforcement period Memorial Weekend. Mad River Brewery decolonize beer. And the 32nd anniversary of the bombing of an environmental activist, Judy Berry. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more. Coming right up. The California Highway Patrol is preparing for a maximum enforcement period where they will be looking for all traffic violations, including failure to wear a seatbelt, driving under the influence, speed, and distracted driving. The MEP will begin this weekend for the Memorial Day holiday.
Oh, hello. My name is Officer Clevenger. I'm with the Garberville CHP office. And this coming weekend marks the Memorial Day weekend, which is a big weekend, big 3-day weekend for most of California. Essentially, it's the start to the summer, and as so every year, what we do is we will have a maximum enforcement program. What that means is, starting on Friday about 6:01, we will enforce essentially most citations for speed, seatbelts. It would be highly enforced by most of our officers. We'll have 80% of our staff out there on the roadways all weekend, and this will continue until Monday night. So our goal is to provide the highest level of safety, service, and security. And by doing so, we're going to, hopefully reduce the number of crashes on the state roads. We'll try to enhance the public safety and deter unsafe driving behavior. Our main goal is to get everyone to travel around California safely and get them to their homes or their destinations. Last year we had 45 people killed during this weekend, and we want to reduce those numbers as much as we can.
Last year, CHP made over 900 DUI arrests across the state and will be ramping up the number of on-duty officers.
We'll put 80% of our staff out there, and we'll record all the numbers of citations, violations, contacts, arrests, crash fatals. And we get all those numbers, and they're combined for all the areas in California. And they go into a data system, which we kind of oversee. Basically, it's a way of hoping to see if we can reduce the amount every year for those specific weekends. For a regular weekend, it would just be, regular areas doing the regular shifts. It's not really feasible to put everyone out on the road on every weekend, which would help reduce and do everything that I just mentioned. But, with the amount of people, it wouldn't be feasible to, staff that at those levels for the whole time. So we do certain weekends, basically holiday weekends, where majority of Californians will be out there driving, hopefully getting to a destination safely, but hopefully we can deter anybody from driving while under the influence or while distracted using their cell phone, driving too fast, making unsafe lane changes, which, there'll be a lot more people on the road this weekend than there will be usually.
Officer Clevenger reminds the public the rules of the road.
So while driving, cell phone use is prohibited. You cannot be using your handheld in your hand. You cannot hold your phone up while talking on it or use it to watch GPS or anything. You can have it linked into a Bluetooth, and you can talk to it through your phone or your vehicle, but it is not allowed to be in your hand and, you know, or up to your ear or anything. For marijuana and alcohol, it's the same rule. You cannot be under the influence, which means that you cannot have an open container of alcohol, you cannot have an open container of marijuana, and you cannot be under the influence of either or. Just drive safe this weekend. Please put on your seatbelts. Take your time. You know, leave a little early if you can. Let someone know when you're leaving and that you're on your way. You know, maintain the speed limit. Be cautious of other drivers and just be patient and, you know, enjoy the weekend, but do it safely and, you know, sober while you're driving.
The maximum enforcement period begins Friday, May 26th at 6 p.m. and will continue through midnight on Monday, May 29th. California State Parks and the Mad River Brewery have teamed up for a historic collaboration that marks a new chapter for the relationship between tribes and government agencies. Linda Cooley, Yurok tribal member and CEO of Mad River Brewery, says their new Canyon of Dreams IPA is a beer for dreamers who imagine the future when Indigenous people everywhere have access to their ancestral land. KMI News spoke with the CEO of Mad River Brewery, which in 2019 became the first tribally owned brewery in the United States, paving the way for others to follow suit.
And we looked at it as an opportunity to really diversify our economic portfolio off the reservation and create jobs and educational opportunities for Indigenous people, but also to have these vessels out spreading messages of what we're fighting for.
Introducing innovative products that champion the ongoing battle for environmental restoration and justice, the Yurok Tribes Brewery is spearheading the creation of a groundbreaking Native American category within the craft beer industry. And the message of this new brew is land access. As Native people have been caretaking the Northern California landscape for time immemorial. However, institutions like state and national parks haven't always worked with tribal peoples to uphold sovereignty. But this new collaborative release is carving a new path forward.
It's been epic, first of all. I never thought in my lifetime that we would have a relationship like this with the state parks, driving by our ancestral territory and having to pay to get in, or seeing history that's painted in one-sided view and is a slap in the face to our family, really, that suffered the consequences for even the names of these state parks. And to have new leadership in the state parks that are saying, hey, we need to pause and stop and really tell the story together and let the people from this land tell it. The current leadership has been working closely with our tribe and many people for the last 3 years to make this happen. We have not only Chapek at Stone Lagoon, but we also have Sume, which the name finally returned to the correct name. And I know they're working on many other things. And during this time, the state park said, hey, we should name a beer after this partnership. We had our historic state park release 2 years ago, and now we're on our second park series beer. And it's really amazing to see not only is the changes that we have here in our county of Humboldt and Del Norte, but the changes that's affecting all over. For really this first historic partnership, I don't think it's ever been done with a state park until here locally.
In 2016, California State Parks North Coast Redwoods District hired a new superintendent, who, since taking leadership, has been dedicated to righting historical wrongs perpetuated or even at times created by the state park system.
Victor Beliant, district superintendent for North Coast Redwoods District, 22 parks from Oregon border down to Laytonville. And what we're trying to do is work with Indigenous folks. We've got 14 different recognized tribes in the district, three counties. and we're trying to give people opportunities to do traditional cultural practices, whether it's ceremony or it's gathering, or even using facilities for whatever organizational initiatives they have going.
It's worth noting that the state park system was created in the late 1920s, and although its founders were able to save and preserve the state's natural beauty, as Griff Griffith, state park interpreter, points out,
they were also eugenicists! So they were like pseudoscience white supremacists, trying to make white supremacy into a pseudoscience.
And throughout her lifetime, Linda Cooley has seen those racist policies carried out, which have been in place for about 100 years. Members of the Wailaki tribe have told our newsroom that state park officials used to call the police on tribal people for trying to gain access to their ancestral lands for cultural purposes. But now, under Blyatt's leadership, State Park is taking a different approach. Like in 2021, when the California State Park and Recreation Commission voted unanimously to change the name of Patrick's Point State Park to Sume, a name used by Yurok people to describe the area since time immemorial.
It's always been known to indigenous folks as Sume. And we honored someone who came in for a three-year period, impacted indigenous people, led some genocidal actions, and we honor them with a geographic land name and with a park name, and we decided that probably wasn't appropriate. And this isn't, you know, it's like I'm working with elders now in their 70s and 80s, who that's one of the first things when I came into this district they asked about. But that's from their parents and their grandparents. This has always been a place that has had an indigenous name. And what we're trying to do, a lot of the stuff we're doing, it's like we've done this, and first that. I want it to be, you know, the 25th, the 58th, the 190th time that it's happened. And what we're trying to do is model that it can happen within government, that we can model this type of relationship in state parks.
Lyatt said he's happy to be a part of the change, but that the movement is very much Native-led.
The shift that we have here, we haven't changed any laws, we haven't changed any policies, but what we've done is utilize what we do have to give people access and to treat human beings like human beings. And what we're doing is trying to engage original stewards of these lands and do what we can to support their revitalization of culture. And you know, it's something that folks are doing, and I'm just giving access to areas. This is something that's completely driven by indigenous folks, and I'm just trying to get government out of the way at times. We've been able to work with the Yurok tribe, and you show a tribal ID, you get into a park and you can gather on a tribal ID, not even with a permit system. When are we going to stop making indigenous practices illegal? Is essentially saying, when are we going to stop making being indigenous illegal?
And Cooley says Mad River Brewery's second installment of their state park series was handcrafted to represent this cultural shift within the institution.
This brew, it's a love letter to all the people that made this happen. My whole life, you dream of, and our whole lives, you dream of a day where there's some kind of fairness and that there's someone that's willing to listen and recognize. And this is really a love letter to all the dreamers out there of saying, don't give up on your dream. This is so many dreams of not just Yurok people, but of Indigenous people all over, of fighting and trying to find that happy medium, and you feel like it's never going to happen. And not just with the state parks, even as an Indigenous woman in the beer business, to be able to do this and not be illustrated as a negative thing with the history of Native Americans and the perception of alcohol. It's all a dream come true. And the dreams of our current leaders in the state parks, the feeling like they can make a change, it's just dreamers. You can't give up on your dreams. You don't know when it can happen, and the moment you stop dreaming is the moment the ability stop to have it come true. Along with this new double IPA that we have that is vibrant and fresh, with still the wonderful hops with this beautiful illustration. We've changed our labeling where we have a story on the side for each beer that we've released, along with the scan app. It's just a beautiful can, and the story is beautiful.
And continuing to pave the way for Native American craft beer, Mad River Brewery has just released their Maize Goddess Indigenous Ale that promotes Indigenous women and Indigenous visibility.
I've really been working hard on creating a product that's more wholly encompassed tribal, with tribal ingredients and more tribal people, and really getting down to the nitty-gritty and breaking that tokenism even further. When you even look in the beer business, some of the categories of beer are really horrific when you look at the history, the names that we put on there and the labels. And our next product is really breaking that mold and setting a standard I hope that other people can see and pick up on. And I'm just really, really excited. I also feel like it's probably our next big beer right up next to Steelhead. So I'm really excited about that, and I can't wait to share it.
And as many work to decolonize the Western world, Mad River is decolonizing beer.
I would 100% say that. The whole entire business is very colonized, and even though we have all these cool clubs now in the beer business, it's not very inclusive still. And it's really hard, especially during the pandemic, I noticed, as an Indigenous business, to get ahead and get recognition and be seen seriously. So I truly hope that we're not just changing the beer industry, but I hope we're changing business in general.
You can find the Canyon of Dreams IPA, the Maize Indigenous Goddess, or their classic favorites like the Steelhead Ale or their Undam Huckleberry Seltzer at their tap room in Blue Lake, in local stores, and at the upcoming Oyster Festival in Arcata. Mad River Brews are also available at Oracle Park in San Francisco, the first tribal product to ever be served in a professional sports stadium.
I want to thank everyone for being so supportive and understanding. And I feel like our stories have been hitting a lot of people who are not Indigenous and who can appreciate it. And I'm just really thankful for that.
More info online at madriverbrewing.com. Turning to Mendocino, multiple solar projects are slated for the county. KZYX's Sarah Wright reports.
As California moves towards electrifying cars and homes, Mendocino County may soon become the site of two small solar projects. Sonoma Clean Power, a community choice aggregator, is working with a developer to plan a solar generation and storage site on Rademeyer Road in Ukiah and a 20-acre solar farm just south of Laytonville. The projects are in the early stages of development but may be up and running by late next year or early 2025. Brian Von Moose is the chief operating officer for Renewable Properties, which is the developer and owner-operator proposing the projects. He gave an overview of the plans.
The Rademeyer Road project is a 4-megawatt AC solar project, 5.5 megawatts DC, coupled with a 4-megawatt 4-hour battery. So on that project, the solar and storage will work in tandem to spread out the solar generation over the day, spread it out to the evenings and nights so that solar can provide a bigger chunk of the load over a bigger period of the day. That's the Rademeyer solar project. The Twin Pine project is a solar-only project. That project is a 5-megawatt AC, 7-megawatt DC solar project. That's the one that's in Laytonville. We executed power purchase agreements with Sonoma Clean Power about the same time. We're in the phase right now where we have completed our interconnection studies, so we know that we can interconnect it with PG&E. We are doing all of our studies to identify any sensitive habitat, cultural, all the studies we need to do to get our ducks in a row to make sure that we can design a solar project that has minimal impact on the environment there and the local community.
Deb Emerson, the managing director of Sonoma Clean Power, said the power from the project would be available to local customers.
Both of these projects are the first projects that Sonoma Clean Power has done that are at the utility scale in Mendocino County. So we're really happy about that. And both of these will be used to supply our Evergreen product. And our Evergreen product is local renewable. So it's being produced locally in our service territory. It supplies our Evergreen customers, which can then be used 24 hours of the day because we source that or pair that with the geothermal contracts that we have in our local service territory as well.
Sonoma Clean Power currently has about 500 Evergreen customers in Mendocino County. The two projects could power about 2,000 homes between them. They will be dependent on PG&E.
Sonoma Clean Power is not a distribution company. We are sourcing the energy, but we do rely on the utility, the investor-owned utility, to actually get that power to the customers. So they own the lines and the infrastructure, and that type of relationship won't change.
At a Laytonville Municipal Advisory Council meeting on April 26th, members were most concerned about environmental mitigations and how many jobs the project would bring to the area. Von Moos said complete studies of potential wetlands, possible rare plants, and wildlife are not completed yet.
You know, we will have a full and complete wetlands delineation, which will tell us exactly where the wetlands are. Our strategy around that is to avoid them. We don't want to encroach on the wetlands. And so we'll have the proper delineation to make sure that we have the proper setbacks. The other studies are ongoing, and I don't know many of the details on them, but obviously we'll know more about that when we get closer to the permitting period.
And another issue that's a really large topic of concern for folks in this area is herbicides. Are there plans to use herbicides to keep the fire danger from weeds down? How is that going to be handled?
Through the process, we'll figure out what the best solution is. You know, if the concern is about fire danger, we are used to building projects in Northern California in the foothills and having to keep the weeds low to the ground. We mow these sites frequently because the weeds can grow up high enough to impact the solar energy. So we're already wanting to keep the weeds low. But in some areas, we've had to keep to a certain standard height. And so we've had to increase our mowing to make sure that the weeds are low enough to meet any sort of fire concerns. On the herbicides, you know, it kind of depends. You know, we'll see what sort of environmental impacts they may have. The only times I can think of us using herbicides has been related to pollinator habitats, where the pollinator advisors have recommended a certain amount of use of herbicides in order to allow us to convert the existing, you know, area into a suitable pollinator habitat. So we'll just have to sort of, you know, navigate those two things as we move forward here.
And you mentioned earlier that you're interested in creating jobs. So I'm wondering what kinds of jobs will come with these projects.
I'd classify them in kind of two buckets, construction jobs and ongoing operation and maintenance jobs. You know, the projects will, you know, typically we hire local contractors who end up building the projects. Electrical contractors, civil, you know, all the work required to install the racking, the solar panels themselves, to electrically wire and connect them, and then to connect them to the grid. So that whole suite of construction jobs will be related to the project. And then on an ongoing basis, you know, they don't require a lot of personnel. They're quiet. They just kind of sit there and work. But we do need folks not far away to respond to any potential outages or any other issues. And so that's the sort of ongoing piece.
Emerson said people who want to find out more can contact Sonoma Clean Power, which is on the web at sonomacleanpower.org. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Reinhardt. For all our local news with photos and more, visit kzyx.org.
On May 24th, 1990, two local environmental activists were bombed while driving their car in Oakland, California. Judy Berry was severely injured by the pipe bomb, which was located under the seat of her vehicle. Daryl Cherney, her passenger, suffered minor injuries. Both Berry and Cherney were arrested, charged with the transportation of illegal explosives. Berry and Cherney would later be exonerated of those charges and go on to file a lawsuit against the FBI and Oakland Police Department for civil rights violations. Judy Berry would commonly say things like, quote, "The FBI should find who bombed me and fire them," end quote. The following is a clip from the documentary Who Bombed Judy Berry. and we let Barry explain what happened.
On May 24th of 1990, I was bombed and nearly killed in a car bomb assassination attempt. I was driving my car, and I was driving down the street, and I was following somebody. At a certain point, I think she was getting ready to make a turn, and I was trying to follow her and realized I wasn't going right, and I quickly hit the brake. And at the time when I hit the brake, there was a very huge explosion, and I felt it rip through me, the explosion being so powerful that the sound itself had a force. The next thing I remember, the car was stopped, and there were people around, and I was in incredible pain that I had never felt before. I knew my back was broken. My legs both were immobile at the time. I knew that my body was ruined. I knew that I was paralyzed. I felt that I was dying.
I heard a crack, and then my whole head started to ring. Then I heard somebody scream out, "It's a bomb. There was a bomb." And then it all made sense that someone had tried to kill us.
The last voice you heard was Daryl Cherney calling into KMUD Radio shortly after the bombing. Just before Barry's death, she explained the details of the lawsuit.
Ultimately, you started this lawsuit, correct?
No. Daryl started this lawsuit. I was still too disabled to deal with lawsuits.
What was it you hoped to achieve by pursuing the lawsuit?
Justice.
We've charged him with false arrest, illegal search and seizure, unequal protection of the law, and conspiracy to violate our First Amendment rights by discrediting us as terrorists.
Judy Barry passed on March 2, 1997, before the lawsuit was settled. Daryl Cherney, however, continued the fight.
The jury today found that 6 of 7 law enforcers themselves broke the law, violated civil rights, in essence, framing Cherney and Barry.
Now, 12 years later, a jury has awarded Cherney and the late Judy Barry $4.4 million for illegal search and false arrest.
I feel a great relief. I feel a great sadness that Judy is not here to experience this victory. But then I also know that Judy Barry is here in a way. Her spirit has been in this courtroom for this entire time.
In 2002, they won the lawsuit and were awarded $4.4 million for civil rights violations by the FBI and Oakland Police Department. The authorities did not investigate any other suspects. The question still remains, who bombed Judy Barry? In state news, civil rights group claim California's prisons are defying the court order to pause solitary confinement. Ellie Prickett Morgan reports.
In 2009, two California prison inmates sued to stop the state prison system from using indefinite solitary confinement as a punishment for prisoners, saying it violated their Eighth Amendment rights against cruel and unusual punishment. Jules Lobel is an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. He says that those inmates' lawsuits led to a class action suit in 2012 to put an end to indefinite solitary confinement in state prisons.
Over 1,000 people were being kept in indeterminate solitary confinement at Pelican Bay State Prison in Northern California. And at the time we brought the case, almost 100 people had been there for over 20 years, and about 500 had been there in solitary confinement for over 10 years.
According to reporting from Mother Jones, a prisoner could be sent to solitary confinement for arbitrary reasons like gang affiliation. The report said things like a birthday card with Aztec art could be used to determine whether or not someone belonged to a gang. After thousands of prisoners across the state engaged in hunger strikes in 2011 and 2013, the state settled the class action suit in 2015. The following year, the number of prisoners in isolation statewide fell by 65% thanks to the reforms resulting from the inmates' lawsuit. The legal battle did not end there. Lobel says that in 2015 and again in 2017, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, or CDCR, was put under court-ordered monitoring due to serious and systemic due process violations. Center for Constitutional Rights attorneys say that the issues continue in the state's prisons, and that's why the group is continuing to pursue court monitoring. LaBelle alleges that the state is engaging in unjust practices to get inmates to admit to violations that would require them to be sent into isolation.
Let's say the state tells a guy that we have an informant who ID'd you in a Simmons lineup. And in fact, it's just not true.